Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, the risky strategy of sending weapons to Libya. France fights discrimination with shock spots. Baby steps to maintain Germany's welcoming culture for migrants.
The atmosphere definitely has changed, and we can see this in Angela Merkel's surrounding as well, that people are not as open as they were in the beginning. But we just keep going with small steps. What else can we do?
And why prominent Czechs care about Britain staying in the EU. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. European governments, the United States and other world powers, said this week they will supply Libya's UN-backed government with weapons to help it fight Islamic State. The communique was issued at the end of talks in Vienna, attended by US Secretary of State John Kerry and top officials from more than 20 nations. Libya descended into chaos after the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi. Rival militias are battling for power there, and Islamic State has established a foothold in the country. European governments are particularly concerned about a mass influx of refugees and migrants from Libya. Our correspondent Kerry Skyring was at the Libya summit in Vienna. He says supplying weapons to Libya is a risky move.
Yes, it is a gamble, but it is one that the United States and more than a dozen countries from the region who were at this summit, they were countries from the Middle East and Europe, they seemed prepared to take it. The main risk they're worried about is that the weapons fall into the wrong hands, especially ISIS, because the government doesn't have control of all the armed forces in the country or even all of the resources or geography of the country. And since that announcement has been made, there has been fighting between forces loyal to the government and ISIS. That's near the city of Misrata. A very unclear situation there. They have apparently taken back some ground, the government forces, that was recently captured by Islamic State. But this is a very to-and-fro situation. There is also still a United Nations Security Council weapons embargo on Libya, and that was placed because they didn't know where weapons going to Libya would end up. So that will have to be lifted for deliveries to begin. But you had the five permanent members of the Security Council here for the talks, so presumably when Libya asks for the lifting and for the weapons, it should happen.
Well, the aim of the Libya summit was to bring stability to that country. If they achieve that, will it mean fewer migrants crossing the Mediterranean from Libyan ports to Europe?
It should, and it was Germany especially that was stressing this point. Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier said the government of national accord in Libya had to be supported so that it becomes an effective force against people smugglers who profit from putting refugees into unsafe boats and taking them across the Mediterranean, and often, in too many cases, ending in tragic results. The United Nations last estimate was as many as 800,000 people waiting in Libya to cross to Europe. So it's with that in mind that they're putting in this effort now to try and stabilise Libya. Interesting that Italy co-chaired this meeting with the United States, and it obviously has a vested interest in seeing stability return to Libya, because many of those desperate refugees end up on the Italian coast, or the Italian Coast Guard is forced to rescue them from the sea. Also, it means that humanitarian aid could be used more effectively to care for refugees inside Libya.
How serious is the threat from ISIS to Libya?
John Kerry made much of this. The US Secretary of State cited the threat from ISIS on a number of occasions, and there are quite a few independent observers of it as well, saying ISIS, as it's forced out of other areas, say in Syria or Iraq, could become very powerful within Libya. So John Kerry says it's a big threat. The Libyan Premier Thayez al-Sarraj said his government would soon submit a weapons list to the Security Council because he said, we have a major challenge ahead of us in fighting extremists. And German Foreign Minister Walter Steinmeier also said the key question is whether Libya remains a place where terrorism, human smuggling and instability continue to expand, or if we can bring this government of national unity to a point where Libya recovers stability. So this summit was all about throwing the weight of more than 20 nations behind that unity government to try to prevent Libya sliding further into chaos. But it has to be said, it's just an attempt at this stage, and the challenges obviously are quite daunting.
And that was Kerry Skyring talking from Vienna. France remains under a state of emergency after the terrorist attacks last November, which killed 130 people. And the events of that night have had another fallout. Statistics point to an increase in anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim acts. Experts say communicating against intolerance is needed more than ever in France, where the Council of Europe says hate speech has become commonplace. French authorities have taken note. In recent weeks, they've released a pair of hard-hitting communications campaigns to fight hate speech and workplace discrimination. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Senegalese immigrant Yacouba Cissé is hunting for work as a cook, but the pickings are slim.
At some restaurants, people will look at the color of my skin and ask if I'm looking for a job as a dishwasher. Especially after the Paris terrorist attacks, I've had problems with work and in public transport.
Fatigue, ça craint. C'est quoi ces traditions d'un autre âge?
In some ways, Cissé, who is Muslim, could be a poster child for a pair of national anti-discrimination campaigns. The French government rolled out the first one a few weeks ago. Six 30-second spots aired on French TV under the hashtag Tous Unis Contre la Haine, or Everyone United Against Hatred.
L'antisémitisme, ça commence par des mots. Ça finit par des crachats, des coups, du sang. Réagissons. Tous unis contre la haine.
The videos depict bleak scenarios, distraught Muslims finding a pig's head stuck to a mosque gate, death to Jews written on a synagogue door, a black man getting beaten up. Authorities say they're all inspired by real events.
And we had to create a shock, to have some impact on people, to say just, hey, stop, we have to address these issues. We can't just go like, no, it's that's nothing, it will... We'll go through it. No, we don't go through it. We face it or we don't.
That's Gilles Clavreul, who heads DILCRA, an interministerial watchdog against racism and discrimination. The videos are the first public messaging of a three-year, 100 million euro government plan to roll back prejudice in France. Launched last year, it includes an arsenal of proposals, from deepening sanctions against hate speech to school and citizen education drives.
The core of the French society respond pretty well to what's going on and has, through a very open-minded view of what is the French society today, that is pretty multicultural, pretty open, pretty globalized, and true, really tolerant to other cultures. But on the margins of the French society, we also have ideologies. We cannot afford to just sit and watch the show of rising populism, extremism, radicalism in all its forms.
Statistics point to a long road ahead. Hate offenses rose by more than one-fifth last year overall. Anti-Muslim acts tripled. Anti-Semitic ones dropped only slightly. They're still worryingly high. But surprisingly, a new study by France's National Human Rights Commission also finds that a feeling of tolerance actually rose in 2015, despite or maybe because of the Paris terrorist attacks. Christine Lazerge heads the commission, which is known as CNDCH.
Il y a un besoin de fraternité. Un besoin de république.
It shows there's a need for fraternity within the French Republic, of social cohesion that makes people open up more to those who are different. It doesn't mean there will be fewer delinquent acts, but it's a positive signal for living together in France.
Anti-discrimination activists and interest groups support the government's overall goal, but not necessarily the messaging. Roger Kuckermann, who heads the Jewish umbrella organization CRIF, says the TV ad campaigns are not efficient in fighting hate.
It's a matter of education. The work has to be done in the schools and with the parents. The youngsters were not born anti-Semitic. They became.
Others say the videos offer a narrow, overly violent interpretation of prejudice. Lazerge of the Rights Commission says they can even be counterproductive.
Elle est contre-productive parce que Nous et bien d'autres, nous travaillons depuis des années à montrer que le racisme, c'est subtil.
We've worked for years to show that racism is subtle. Even those who are not overtly racist can use, perhaps inadvertently, humiliating or wounding words.
The government has taken a different approach with its second national anti-discrimination campaign, rolled out a few weeks later. Giant posters inside metros and other transport hubs show job seekers with their faces split in half, white and non-white. On the white side are messages like, "You start Monday." On the non-white, "You don't have the profile." The drive's tagline is "Skills come first." Once again, numbers back it up. A study by Paris think tank the Montaigne Institute, for example, shows Muslim job seekers have to send 5 times more CVs to get a single callback than Christian ones. Montaigne's deputy director, Angèle Malâtre-Lansac, says job discrimination among Muslims here is far higher than against African Americans in the United States.
On a déduit de ça qu'il y avait vraiment un enjeu fort, c'est-à-dire qu'on pense pas qu'il y ait un racisme dans toute la société française.
It's not necessarily that racism is pervasive, but religious practice can make recruiters afraid. Businesses don't know how to react to France's secularism laws.
The poster campaign is good, she says, but how will it be followed up? Back to Cisse, the Senegalese cook. He's on his way to an unemployment office, but he doesn't have much hope of finding a job or in the government communication campaigns.
Je trouve que pour avoir de l'égalité dans ce pays-là, ça va pas être possible. Ça va, bon, je dis rien n'est possible, mais je pense que ça va pas être. C'est pas maintenant, quoi.
Cisse believes equality is impossible in France. Well, nothing is impossible, he adds, but at least that equality will not be a reality anytime soon. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
Following the closure of the Balkan route to migrants in March, the number of refugees arriving in Germany has dropped from thousands per day to less than 200. With over 1 million newcomers already in the country, though, the focus has shifted to integrating those who will be allowed to stay. It's a challenge that's been hampered by anti-immigrant protests in some parts of Germany, and a new right-wing party, the Alternative for Germany, or AfD, has made electoral gains with its strong anti-immigrant platform. But as Alexa Devorsen has been finding out, the welcoming culture that first greeted refugees late last year is still thriving in some quarters.
Willkommen! Hallo! Willkommen!
Once a week, the owners of this rural guest house turn the dining area into an open space they call the World Cafe, where refugees staying in temporary lodging nearby can get acquainted with locals over coffee and tea. It's part of a wider community initiative to help refugees adjust to a new society.
My name is Claudia. I'm a veterinarian, and we are here in the center of Werder an der Havel, which is approximately 50 kilometers southwest of Berlin. We have been traveling quite a lot in Europe and Asia, and now we have the chance to give back some of the hospitality that we experienced in all these countries.
On other days, Claudia hosts the World Kitchen when she invites women refugees, many of whom have never been to school, to cook their favorite dishes from home and learn some basic German while they're at it. That's been a hit, not least because of the food served in some refugee centers in the evenings.
Bread, butter, tea, cheese, sometimes kalbas. Kalbas means
cabbage.
Cabbage, yeah. It means Afghani food, yeah?
On this day, all the cafe guests are from Afghanistan, and Abdullah Had Nazari has been translating their remarks from Farsi. His father, a police officer from Kunduz, realized he could no longer protect his family after getting threatening phone calls from the Taliban. So they fled overland to Iran, then through Turkey, across the Mediterranean in a rubber boat, and north to Germany along the Balkan route before it was closed to migrants. Abdullahad's younger siblings are already enrolled in school, and he's excited about his own future here.
It's good. I am trying to learn German. I want to study. I want to be an educated person. I want to study computer science because in Afghanistan, I studied DIT, CIT, BBA, Bachelor in Business Administration, and now I want to study just computer science. I like computer science.
Those acronyms stand for Digital Imaging Technology and College of Information Technology. So at 23, Abdullahad has a good chance of furthering his training and joining the German workforce once he gets refugee status. But fears that Germany could be a target of terror attacks have given way to a growing sense of mistrust that has clouded that initial optimism reflected in Chancellor Angela Merkel's refrain, Wir schaffen das, or we can manage this.
The atmosphere definitely has changed, and we can see this in Angela Merkel's surrounding as well, that people are not as open as they were in the beginning. But we just keep going with small steps. What else can we do?
But in some cases, small steps can make all the difference. In Berlin, one family's gesture has changed the course of a refugee's life. Bülent Gündoğdu and his family were so saddened by the migrant crisis that they felt they had to do something.
It all started with the heart-wrenching TV pictures, all the reports from the war in Syria, and the whole drama that unfolded with so many children who drowned. That made our family want to help children in some way, since they're caught up in the misdeeds of adults and wars they can't do anything about. They suffer so much.
In Syrien heute kein Wasser, kein Licht, alles kaputt.
That's Momo, a Syrian boy from the besieged city of Aleppo, who's now living with the Gündoğdu family. With the blessings and prayers of his aging parents, Momo made the dangerous trip to Germany late last year. He's one of an estimated 60,000 unaccompanied minors who've arrived in this country. He recently celebrated his 14th birthday with the Gündoğdus after they contacted the child protection authorities about their willingness to shelter a child refugee.
Ich bin nicht hier geboren. Ich war ein paar Jahre jünger als Momo, als ich nach Deutschland kam.
Bülent was a little younger than Momo is now when he came to West Germany with his parents, who were part of the first generation of guest workers from Turkey. Today, he's a German citizen, a father of four who works as a caretaker at the high school next door. That's where Momo is taking German classes. He loves math and says he wants to study to be an engineer. The day we met, he'd been invited to see a movie.
Ja, aber ich diese alles für mich nicht glücklich. Nicht glücklich in meine Eltern hier.
He says nothing really makes him happy. He just wants to see his parents again.
Aber Momo liebt Bewegung. Momo liebt aktiv sein. Momo lernt schnell.
But Bülent, who along with his wife is now Momo's legal guardian, is optimistic about Momo's adjustment to his new life. He says Momo loves to be active and he learns fast because he never stops asking questions.
Baba's Kopf platzt. Baba's Kopf kaputt.
My head is about to pop, he jokes, but it's worth it.
Ich hier immer in Schule mit 18 nicht stopp, Schluss und nochmal.
Momo is already set on continuing his studies here. He says even if the war in Syria ends, he'll never go back. Instead, he wants to work so he can build a big house in Berlin when he becomes an engineer, so that his parents and grown siblings, who are scattered all over Europe and the Middle East, can live under one roof. He could be a refugee success story in the making. Alexa Dvorsen, DW Radio, Berlin.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. It's just a month to go before the people of Britain go to the polls to decide whether their country should stay in the EU. And both the Brexit and Remain camps are well and truly slogging it out at home and abroad. This week it was the turn of the Czechs to have their say on the matter. Some three dozen public figures have now signed an open letter calling on the Brits not to bid farewell to Europe. Rob Cameron has this report from Prague.
A piece of music called In the Tatra Mountains
performed here by the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra under the baton of the renowned Czech conductor Libor Pešek. Mr. Pešek, who spent over a decade at the head of that orchestra, is one of those Czechs with a close affinity with the UK. His uncle was one of the hundreds of Czechoslovak pilots who flew with the RAF during the war. This week, the conductor added his name to an open letter calling on Britain to stay in the EU. In his top-floor flat a few minutes from Prague Castle, I asked him why.
I think it's a tiny contribution, but I think one has to express his feelings for the situation, so I did it.
Do you think it will do any good, this public open letter?
No. But I feel we all have to do what we can.
Obviously, everybody looks at the whole debate about Europe's future and the European Union and Britain's place in it in a different way. As an artist, as a musician, as a conductor, what do you think the EU and membership in it has done for the arts in Europe, particularly classical music, your field?
First of all, it opened the door for people from other nations of Europe to join the British orchestras, because I remember the times when the unions in London didn't allow to have engaged anyone who didn't have a British passport.
The letter was penned by the former Czech ambassador to London, Michal Jantowski, and addressed to the Czech-born playwright Sir Tom Stoppard. It's been signed by senior academics, judges, former diplomats, religious leaders, and several celebrities, names that range from the Archbishop of Prague, Dominik Duka, to the Czech supermodel Eva Herzigova of Wonderbra fame. The four-page letter is an appeal to the ties that bind Britons and Czechs, as well as the UK's long relationship with Europe, as I found out from the man who wrote it, Michal Jantowski, who now heads the Václav Havel Library in Prague.
We did not want to delve into the technical arguments on the pros and cons of the membership in the UK, but rather on the history of Britain's relationship with Europe, of its interconnectedness throughout the centuries. And all in all, you know, this comprises a story more than 2,000 years long of interconnectedness, mutual dependence, and reinforcing the values that we hold dear in each other.
But that story wouldn't end overnight if Britain voted to leave the EU, would it?
It most certainly would not end overnight, but we feel it would become more difficult, more complicated, and maybe less prosperous for both of us.
The three dozen signatories certainly represent a broad cross-section of the Czech elite, but there is, of course, a strong undercurrent of Euroscepticism in Czech society. Support for membership has fallen sharply in the last few years, and that's been exacerbated by Europe's failure to deal effectively with the migrant crisis. Indeed, there are some in this country who fear if Brexit does happen, it won't be long before we're talking about the prospect of Chexit. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Coming up over the next half hour, France prepares for its biggest ever security operation. Why soccer is more than a game to Kurds in Turkey.
Ahmet Spor is more than a sports team. In its essence, it represents resistance and a sports culture that aims to reflect people's freedom. It is, in a way, becoming a voice of resistance against unfairness, violence and pressure in an environment of war.
Also on the show, the vending machine that dispenses short stories. And Greeks look for culinary solutions to economic hardship. Stay tuned for those stories and more. One of the world's biggest sporting events will get underway in France next month amidst unprecedented security. The Euro 2016 Soccer Championship begins on June the 10th and will run for a month at 10 stadiums across the country. About 2.5 million spectators are expected for 51 matches involving 24 teams. Well, my colleague Chuck Penfold from DW Sports Desk will be covering the championship. He told me which measures are being taken to try and secure the tournament against potential attacks.
Well, the first thing the French are doing and the organizers is throwing a lot of money at this. They say they've set aside 34 million euros to try to secure the tournament, which for the first time will be made up of 24 teams, so an expanded tournament over 10 stadiums. 12,000 police and security forces are going to be involved in the security, as well as 10,000 members of the military. They've been conducting a number of, dozens, in fact, of exercises to prepare for any terrorist attack or any other eventuality to protect the fans and the players from any attack.
I believe, in fact, that the authorities will also be deploying anti-drone technology in no-fly zones.
Yes, I've read about this too, but what's not really clear to me is what this anti-drone technology is. Apparently, they're not going to try to shoot them down. What they're going to do is they're going to set up no-fly zones, a rather large radius around the stadia, so any possible drones, I mean, these can be anything. There was a recent exercise where they simulated a chemical attack on a stadium, on the stadium in Saint-Étienne that's going to be used for the Euro. They say they don't necessarily expect something like that, but they have to be ready for any eventuality. They've also said they're not sure how well this anti-drone technology will work because drones are such a new technology and nobody really has too much experience with it. But we have seen in the past that one can be, if you have a no-fly zone flown into a stadium, with the Albania-Serbia situation a couple of years ago when somebody flew a drone with an Albanian flag into the stadium in Belgrade and basically caused a riot.
Are all these measures and the fact that France has already experienced deadly terrorist attacks putting off the fans, do you think?
No, it doesn't seem that way. It seems to be the case that people are really putting their trust in these security measures and the French authorities. I've read that 2.5 million tickets for the event have already been sold and that just a few thousand are left to be purchased over the internet. So there doesn't seem to be any negative effect on sales at all.
Well, you'll be covering the tournament for Deutsche Welle. Any hot tips here on who might win it?
Well, of course, Germany, as the reigning World Cup champions, have to be right up there with the favourites. Joachim Löw this week just named his provisional squad, and that has 14 members of that World Cup winning team in it. Another team to look out for, I guess, would be France. They're a pretty strong team, but they're also playing at home, and home advantage can often play a role. And then some would even say the English in particular are getting their hopes up with some young players that have come along there in the last couple of years, like the very hot Harry Kane from Tottenham Hotspur, as well as his teammate Dele Alli. And of course, from that Cinderella team, Leicester, Jamie Vardy, another very prolific scorer.
And are you looking forward to covering the tournament despite all these security preparations?
Absolutely. I had my security briefing fairly recently, and that was quite reassuring. There's lots of measures in place basically for everybody. I think dealing with this security these days is just sort of a sign of the times. I was at the International against Italy in Munich a few weeks ago, and we were very carefully controlled. Even our car had a mirror run underneath it as we drove into the stadium. We went through an X-ray device like you'd see in an airport. But there was no real sense of nervousness or anything like that. I think people are generally happy to see that the security forces are on their toes, and it's just a fact of life these days.
And that was my colleague Chuck Penfold from DW's sports desk. We stay on the subject of soccer and head to the southeast of Turkey. The region has been hit by repeated attacks by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, as Turkish security forces try to crush a Kurdish insurgency. Fighting restarted last year after a 2-year ceasefire broke down. Just last week, another car bomb targeting a police unit killed 3 people and wounded over 40 in Diyarbakir, the main city in the region. But many Kurds in the region are trying to escape the violence by focusing on the success of their soccer team, Ahmetspor. The football club is becoming a symbol of hope for them, as Dorian Jones reports.
Fans celebrating another victory for their beloved Ahmetspor. But it's not just winning that makes this club so special, according to this supporter who did not want to give his name.
Ahmetspor is more than a sports team. In its essence, it represents resistance and a sports culture that aims to reflect people's freedom. It is, in a way, becoming a voice of resistance against unfairness, violence and pressure in an environment of war.
Diyarbakir for the last 6 months has been the centre of fighting between the army and Kurdish rebels. The city is now in the iron grip of security forces. Despite fans having to pass through hundreds of riot police and armoured vehicles, the club remains a symbol for Kurds. Even more so after it changed its name from Diyarbakir to Ahmetspor, Ahmet being the Kurdish name for the city. Chairman of the club, Ali Karakash, says the club is more than just a football team.
There is a Kurdish problem in this country. People are demanding a way to express themselves. Ahmetspor is seen as a voice for the people of this region, representing people in and outside the city. It is a very important representation of the people of this city. And especially after changing the name to Ahmetspor last year, it became more important for the people in the region, not only for Diyarbakir.
But for many, Ahmetspor is a marked club, especially when it travels. In a recent away game, 5 club executives suffered concussion and broken noses after being attacked by opposing supporters. Ahmetspor is often accused of being terrorist supporters by opposing fans, a stance echoed in Turkish newspapers and social media. Often the club struggles to find a hotel to stay in. Players too have been punished. Star player Deniz Narki was banned for 12 games for a tweet calling for peace and an end to fighting between Kurdish rebels and security forces. At the training ground, the players and managers try to stay focused on winning. Team coach Sertaç Kucukbayrak admits this year has been especially hard, but says they are inspired by their fans whose support continues to grow.
The loss of one of our best players for so many games was hard, and the team and hostility we face can be difficult. But it is very exciting to have such a passionate fan base. Since we changed our name to Ahmetspor, the supporters identified much more with the team. People come to our games not only from Diyarbakir, but from all over the region. In the next phase, I believe Ahmetspor will grow and become an even more important club with greater goals.
Those efforts got an important boost with Narki back from his 12-match ban. While he says he's still angry about the ban, he says he's using that anger for the team and supporters.
I personally get more motivated. When they throw insults at me, I get more motivated to play. Instead of taking one step, I take 10 steps. I'm not getting disturbed anymore because we got used to it, as it happens in each away game. We hope this doesn't go on like this. We hope the other home teams show us the hospitality we showed them when they come to Diyarbakir. But even if they don't, we focus on our game and we play to win.
For now, that philosophy seems to be working. With Naki back in the team, the club is on a winning streak, and with it, hopes of a playoff place and a chance to enter the Premier League. For the fans, those troubles makes a bond between the club and its supporters stronger, says this fan, who did not want to give his name.
Amedspor is important for reflecting all the emotions of the Kurdish people on the football field. For us, it became a place where we can pour out all our emotions. We can't do all the things we want to do, but thanks to Amedspor, we can express ourselves.
While for this supporter, it's simple.
We see Amedspor as the national team of Kurdistan. When we win, we see that victory as a national victory.
Many already call Amedspor the Barcelona of the Kurds, in the hope that the club will share the same success as Barcelona and the freedom its Catalan fans enjoy. Doreen Jones, DW, Diyarbakir.
From football to pelota. This is a sport played in Spain's Basque country, which has long been known for its distinct identity. It involves a ball being whacked against a stone wall and was first played in the Middle Ages. There are many different ways of playing pelota. The ball can be struck with the player's bare hands, with a curved basket, or with a wooden club. But there's been growing concern in recent years that the sport is in a decline that could lead to its virtual extinction. Guy Hedgeco reports from the Basque Country.
The pelota court in the small town of Oiartzun is full of local fans who've come to watch a Friday night professional game. They cheer as the two players whack a small leather-bound ball against the wall with their bare hands. It's a passionate scene, with TV cameras broadcasting the game live and children chanting the players' names between points. All of this would suggest the sport is in good health, but many fear its future is uncertain. Iñaki Osa Goikoetxea is one of the most feted pelota players of recent decades.
I won the world title, the world championship.
He plays Hayalai, in which a long banana-shaped basket is used to catch and throw the ball at speeds of up to 200 miles an hour. The Basques exported Hayalai across the world, to France, Latin America, the Philippines and the United States.
Hayalai was all over the world. I mean, it's very nice for the Basque people that you go anywhere and you see the Hayalai, and everyone knows that what is Hayalai. So that's very important for the Basque culture.
Top Basque Hayalai players used to head to Miami, where gambling financed the sport. Iñaki played there for nearly 20 years. But recently, changes to gambling laws have hurt Hayalai. Iñaki is a multiple world champion, but when his salary was cut by 70% last year, he returned home.
The situation is worse and worse. Every year is getting worse. I feel really bad because I played 20 years Hayalai, like professional, and I'm still playing. But I see that people that is coming behind me, they don't have too many opportunities to play.
Oh, pello, pello, lo gale nauketa.
Back in Spain, the other variations of pelota have also been struggling. 5 years ago, 3,000 players and coaches were registered with the Basque Pelota Federation. By last year, that number was down almost 20%. Spectator figures are also down. Some blame a lack of coordination at the top of the game. Others say soccer and other sports draw young Basques away from pelota. A pelota court, or frontón, can be found in every Basque town. I'm standing in one in Iñaki Osa Goikoetxea's town of Sumaya. There are different types of frontón, but this one is in the open air with two high walls that meet in a corner, and it's dated 1888. These courts are not just used for pelota, though. They're often where town social events and dinners are held. So the pelota court really is at the heart of Basque life. For those who see the sport as a deep expression of Basque identity, Pelota's uncertain future is deeply worrying. Ander Ugarte is a leading manufacturer of Pelota balls and a well-known commentator on the sport.
Que no se podría entender a este pueblo, al pueblo vasco, sin la pelota.
You cannot understand the Basque people without Pelota. If Pelota had been acknowledged as the treasure that it is, it wouldn't be in danger of dying out. But we need to defend what belongs to us. Pelota is about suffering. You have to work at it every day. In the modern world, who wants to suffer? Nobody. It's a lot easier to buy a ticket and win the lottery than to make money by working hard and using those values that Pelota gives you.
But it's not all doom and gloom for Pelota. There is currently an effort in many parts of the Basque Country to get children involved, and they are being taught the sport and its values at places such as this indoor court in Sopela, near Bilbao. Kurene, the Pelota club in this small town, has over 100 players, many of them children. Players from Pelota's different categories are all welcome. Girls and boys play together, and both Spanish and the Basque tongue, Euskera, are spoken at training sessions. Pachi Siskar, the club's head coach, says that inclusiveness is a key part of the education that children receive here.
Aparte que sean buenos peloteros, que sean buenos deportistas.
Besides being good pelota players and good athletes, we want them to be good people, to have the right values regarding their behaviour and how they treat opponents and playing partners. With some children, it's harder work than with others, but we try to give them these values, which we believe are crucial.
It's not the sort of place you'd expect to find British kids. But two of the boys at the club, John and Eneko Beale, aged 12 and 8, have an English father.
How long have you been playing then, John?
Well, I've been here for 2.5 years since I moved here from England when I was 10. I train twice a week and then sometimes I've got a match on Saturday.
And how are your hands? Does it hurt when you hit the ball against the wall?
I've got a special protection that covers the palm of your hand, and that will stop the ball from hurting you.
I'm the mum of John and Eneko. John and Eneko both were born in the UK, but we've moved here about 3 years ago. Well, I guess for us, Pelota is part of Basque culture and our heritage. I think it's a great sport because physically it's demanding, very competitive, but they're very used to losing and winning. They're very used to being exposed, and therefore, even though it's competitive, it's also a great team sport.
The nationalist-led Basque government recently presented a plan to restore some luster to Pelota. It's too soon to know if that will stop the sport's decline. But perhaps just as importantly, a young generation of Basques, such as those in Sopela, is still drawn to the values and thrills of this sport. Guy Hedgeco, DW, The Basque Country.
Well, if you're in need of some cerebral exercise after all that sport, then it's time for a short story. Not from a book or even a Kindle, but from a vending machine. In the French city of Grenoble, there are now dispensing machines that distribute short stories for free. Our reporter John Lawrenson has been finding out the story behind the story machines.
I'm down at the tourist office in Grenoble. There are nets of walnuts for sale, a bit of a local speciality apparently. And in the middle of the room, there is a short story dispenser. It's like one of those machines that give you a number when you're queuing up at the social security office or something. You can have three selections, 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. So I'm going to press on 1 minute because I'm a busy man. It's my story, and it's called Matryoshka Dolls, Poupée Russe.
We were not thinking about work. We were having some snacks at the snack vending machine, and we were wondering how cool it would be to have a vending machine with short stories.
Quentin Pleuplet is one of the directors of Short Editions. It's an online publishing house for short stories, poems and strip cartoons.
So we went back to the office, we hacked together a prototype with some electronics, a very basic one, very small, and then the short story dispenser was born.
Oui, bonjour, Xavier.
D'accord.
The authors, whose work is now juddering out of Grenoble's story machines, are what the French call Sunday writers. They don't expect to be paid for what they write and are pleased to reach a bigger readership than they might already have on social media. I'm going to visit one of them, Xavier Bray.
Bonjour.
He won one of the story competitions Short Editions holds four times a year with a story called In Shape. It's about this young dad who's doing some press-ups. His little girl asks what he's doing. Trying to get into shape, he says. Why? Don't you like your shape? I like your shape, and so on. Ask Xavier if he likes the idea of people pressing a button and randomly receiving a story like this.
Le hasard parfois fait bien les choses. Moi, j'ai des problèmes d'yeux en ce moment, je n'arrive plus à lire, mais...
I like this idea of chance reading. I've got a problem with my eyesight at the moment, so I can't read much. But every day, I go to the bookshelf, pull out a book, and read a page at random. Sometimes it'll make my day. The French novelist Stendhal said that we should write a little bit each day. Doesn't matter if it's good, just write. For reading, it's maybe the same. Read a little bit each day. It feeds your mind.
In front of the town hall, there are people breakdancing. In other cities, security would have moved them on. But Grenoble is the only French city with a Green Party mayor, Eric Piolle. They do things differently, like having all the city's billboards taken down and installing the story machines.
To really bring culture where you don't expect to see culture. And so you take this consumer society symbol and you reuse it for a total different purpose.
Short Edition says they'll soon be installing story machines in Paris and some other French cities before opening in the English language in London and New York. John Lawrenson, DW, Grenoble.
And I'm Helen Senian Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Greeks have become used to trying to survive amidst economic turmoil. The public sector is still shrinking, and more than a fifth of the population are unemployed. So a new generation of Greeks are getting back to basics, seeking out innovative culinary solutions to help them get them through the bad times. And as Heidi Fuller Love has been finding out, they've been rediscovering their culinary heritage along the way.
Here at the Greek Gastronomy Museum near Athens' very hip Psiri district, and just a stroll away from the colourful Varvakio Central Food Market, Konstantinos Matsodelis, one of the museum's 20-something founders, presents the latest exhibition, The Reflection of the Plate.
In Greece, there's a trend with local products. We have more and more of them. People who had office jobs, they had to quit during the crisis and return to their homeland and produce new agricultural products. And more of them, they do also the packaging, and that's one of the good things that the crisis brought to us, the need to produce more on our own.
Working with local artists, he also wanted to support new food businesses set up by fellow graduates who couldn't find work. With his sister, an Athens art curator, he came up with the idea of linking food and art.
We asked 12 artists to work on the topic of Greek cuisine and modern society and how has this influenced one another. So each of the artists presents an exhibit as well as a recipe. We have so many things that we don't know about our culinary culture. There was a period of 20 years that imported products were thought to be better. Nowadays, consumers, they choose again to buy local products. We are very optimistic about the future.
Step outside the halls of the museum, and food is a preoccupation at all levels of society. It has been estimated that 4 in 10 people have difficulty feeding themselves, and countless children are sent to school on empty stomachs.
I've been very blessed in my life, very lucky, and I didn't need to do much to have a fantastic life. So I felt that I need to do something to help these people.
Alexandros Theodoridis is one of the founders of Borome. The name means we can. It's a groundbreaking organization. Based in Athens, it was created to funnel leftover food from different shops, supermarkets and other businesses to people in need via organizations on the ground. Set up in 2012, the organization now donates food provided by organizations ranging from local bakeries to huge multinational chains like IKEA to some 400 welfare organizations. These include old people's homes, soup kitchens and even orphanages.
We function as a virtual food bank, and what we do is, because we didn't have any money to have a warehouse and vehicles to move around, like the classical model of a food bank, we needed to be inventive. And that was fantastic, because we thought, okay, we can just skip logistics, which is 90% of the food saving equation, and we connect directly those who have food with those who need it. So that makes it extremely easy for somebody to give, because he doesn't have anything else to do than call us up. Plus, we can save everything. We save from a bakery, we save food from a private party, we save from weddings, up to Chiquita or the largest food companies in Greece, or IKEA, the stores.
Invention among Greece's generations of graduates is rife. With a lack of jobs in the capital, Athens, however, some have moved back to some of the more remote Greek villages, where they're not only breathing new life into the aging social scene, they are also rehabilitating traditional cooking methods and life skills that would otherwise have been lost. On a busy street corner of Arkan, a Cretan village with some 4,500 inhabitants, Ploumi, named for the endemic purple flower that grows on Cretan slopes, is a cooperative which offers a social restaurant, grocery and cultural activities, including free music classes for children.
Our activities are related to cultural activities, nutrition and Cretan cuisine, and the old professions that have been lost. Our activities are related to people who want to share or learn their talents. And we try to convince more and more people to participate.
One of those office workers mentioned by Konstantinos at the Gastronomy Museum, computer engineer Christoforos Augustiniatos, seized the chance to change direction when work dried up in his hometown Patras in the northern Peloponnese. Arriving in Arkan a few years ago, he helped set up this Cretan cooperative, which currently fosters local initiatives ranging from market gardening to food foraging.
The whole project is not about money. The whole meaning is to give back to people social benefits. When life becomes difficult, believe that we are alone against the problems. But we believe that with teamwork and with cooperatives and with taking our life in our hands and help each other, we'll solve many of the problems.
Greek physician Hippocrates said, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." Born out of the current economic crisis, a new generation of Greeks are hoping that these innovative food projects and others like them will be the long-awaited medicine that will kickstart their country's ailing economy, keeping Greek stomachs full in the process. Heidi Fullerlove, DW Crete.
And that's all we've time for on the show. Hope you enjoyed it. It was produced with help from Emma Wallace and sound engineer Steffi Brown. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. And we'll be back at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.